A dull November morning. In Birmingham's Winston Green Jail, two guards take the elbows of a bewildered young man and march him to the gallows. He is the last to be hanged in that place. This isn't ancient history. It's 1962. The young man is Oswald Gray. He's from Jamaica, and he's been in England for just 2 years. Not heard of this before? You're not alone. It's forgotten history. A bungled robbery, a single shot from a stolen pistol, and newsagent Thomas Bates lies dead in his shop in Lee Bank Road. The law rushes to punish Oswald Gray. 6 months do not pass from the crime to the rope. Young, black, and disposable, he is a victim of miscarried justice. His story shouts to us across the decades. Who Killed Oswald Gray is a story that makes sure that neither Oswald nor Thomas will be forgotten. Episode 1. Lee Bank Road and the Murder of Thomas Bates.
It's chilly on that Saturday evening in 1962, even though it's early June. It's 6:30. In his newsagent on Lee Bank Road, Thomas Bates is just about to shut up shop for the night. Most Saturdays, he'd take his mom, 76-year-old Louisa, for an evening drink at the Welcome Inn on Sun Street. But tonight, she'd settled into the cozy back room behind the shop with her old friend, Sally Hodgkinson. There'd be no shifting them this evening. The shop bell tinkles, and Thomas lifts himself from his armchair to serve one last customer. Every penny counts. That's what had built his steady little business. Probably someone after buying their fags for Saturday night. Or maybe somebody getting their copy of the Argus to check on the cricket scores. Thomas loved his cricket, and most summer Saturdays liked nothing more than to stroll down Persia Road to the county ground to watch it. On Saturday, June 2nd, 1962, for whatever reason, he had decided not to. And so, on the day that he didn't go to the cricket, and on the day that he didn't take his elderly mom for a drink, Thomas Arthur Bates, 47 years old and unmarried, proprietor of L. Bates and Son on Lee Bank Road, got up at 6:30 to make the last sale of the day. Louisa and Sally went back to the telly, Jukebox Jury, a Saturday night favourite. A noise. What exactly? A car backfiring? It sounds too close for it to be that. At the same time, from next door, a heavy thud followed by the sound of things, jars, display shelves, tumbling to the floor. And then the jangle of the shop bell from the door to the street. Louisa exchanges a glance with Sally and calls out, inquiring after her son. Tommy? There is no response. With the slow deliberation of the old ladies they had become, they lift themselves from the settee and make their way into the shop, where, in the cramped space between the counter and the shelves, among piles of magazines and a few sweetie jars, a three-legged stool lying beside him, alongside a small cash tin containing a few coppers, lies Thomas's slumped body. His mom understands immediately what has happened. A reoccurrence of the stomach and heart illnesses that had laid him low months ago and from which he has never fully recovered. A mom knows. But it is Sally who sees the wound, which is steadily seeping blood onto his chest. As Louisa gasps out uncontrollable sobs, it is she who has the presence of mind to go to the scarcely used telephone to call for an ambulance. Even as she does so, She knows it is hopeless. Quite unassumingly, Thomas Bates has met his death, just going about his normal business on an early summer's evening. Of course, our story is about Oswald Augustus Gray, a 20-year-old from Bogwalk, Jamaica. Just 25 weeks after that chilling evening in June, he was hanged for this crime. He was the last man to be hanged at Winston Green Prison and the last black man hanged in Britain. He had been in England for 2 years. 3 years after his execution, capital punishment was made illegal in the United Kingdom. Only 5 more people after Oswald met their deaths in this way until abolition in November 1965, almost exactly 60 years ago. This story will concentrate on how the law and the state treated him, and they did not treat him well. But it will always remember that Thomas Bates was a victim too.
Hi everyone, I'm Jazzy P and I'm a broadcaster and presenter at Genesis Radio Birmingham. And today I'm here with John Berry, the author of Who Killed Oswald Gray. Now John, tell us a bit more about this story.
Oswald Augustus Gray was the oldest of 7 siblings, all born between 1942 and 1955. In Bog Walk, just outside Kingston, Jamaica. We're certain that they all shared the same birth mother, Luletta Butler, and almost 100% certain that they were all the children of Felix, although the records are a bit shaky on that one.
And they all came to Birmingham?
That's right. Felix came over in 1955. It was the common pattern. Get here, try to establish yourself, and gradually bring your children over as and when you could.
And Oswald, being the oldest, was called first in 1960, and he'd be what, coming up to about 18?
Yeah, but it wasn't just because he was the oldest. He'd been a troublesome child, always getting into scrapes. So much so that he spent some time in a reform school in Stony Hill. Minor theft, that kind of thing. He couldn't get on at school, Tulloch Primary, and remained pretty well illiterate all his short life. So Felix's idea was to get him over here, get him into work, and just generally straighten him out.
But that didn't quite work out, did it? He was in trouble almost as soon as he arrived, wasn't he? And something about an electric meter?
I'm afraid so. It was obviously a bewildering time for him. When he got here, he found that his father had taken up with another woman, Beatrice Shields, in a house in Gordon Road, Lascelles. Felix tried to get him into regular work, garage hand, labourer, but he just couldn't hold down a job. Timekeeping, absence, that kind of thing. So he was short of money and he'd already managed to find himself some questionable companions.
And I guess that's where the electric meter comes in.
Yes. And in the very house in Gordon Road where he was living with his father and Beatrice and someone we'll come to later in the story, her daughter Phyllis. He'd jimmied open the meter and took the few precious shillings in there. And that's far from the end of the story.
And that's because his father Felix chose to report him to the police, didn't he?
Exactly. You have to imagine that Felix was at the end of his tether. He'd bought this troubled boy here at some expense, an airfare of £85, and given him his chance, found him some work, and now this. The same old pilfering and refusing to buckle down to work. In my book, I've tried to imagine the scene at Ladywood Police Station, where he tells the desk sergeant of this petty domestic crime. But it is difficult to get your head round handing your own son in that way.
And in those times with some serious consequences.
Very serious. There had been, times never change, a bit of a moral panic about youth crime. And so a series of what we'd now call youth offender institutions had recently been established. The one in Birmingham was actually housed in Winston Green Prison, and that's where he went for 3 months.
So I asked you at the start what you knew about Oswald, and it's not a pretty picture, is it? Time spent in correctional facilities, both in Jamaica and Birmingham, pretty well illiterate, reluctant to settle into work, and, as we know, vulnerable to falling into bad company, of which he'd find plenty now that he'd been moved into criminal circles.
And that bad company wasn't slow to spot him, I'm afraid. Once out of detention, Oswald ditched his given name and insisted on being called Roy. And like you say, he was an easy and vulnerable mark. He'd already been spotted by fellow Jamaican, Harris Charles Carniff. Now, Carniff had been in the UK for 12 years and had already had 3 spells in jail. Like Oswald, Roy, he had his street moniker, Mover, and he was determined that from now on, when it came to the petty crime that was the hallmark of his life, it wouldn't be him who was left carrying the can. Oswald was an easy dupe for him, and he was going to take him for all he was worth, which, of course, wasn't a lot.
The ambulance carrying Thomas sped off from Lee Bank Road to the Central Hospital in Steelhouse Lane, where he was announced dead on arrival. By then, Detective Chief Superintendent Gerald Baumber was already at the scene. He knew the importance of evidence gathered in this first crucial hour. Baumber knew Lee Bank well. A couple of years back, he tracked down the murder of typist Stephanie Beard in the YWCA hostel on Wheelies Road. It had been a gruesome, bloody business. A girl had been raped and horribly mutilated. To the dismay of Gerald Baumber and his colleagues, the madman who'd done it, Patrick Byrne, escaped the gallows, claiming insanity. Baumber had no truck with such nonsense. He chatted to locals near the Bates' shop and learnt that not many people had been around to witness much at all. But those who had all told him the same thing. They had all seen, in the language of the day, a coloured man in the vicinity of the shop at around 6:30. Not much, but something. The next few days, Baumber used all available manpower and his wide range of informers, concentrating his efforts round the cramped bedsits of Lascelles, Handsworth and Bossall Heath, areas where those who'd come from the Caribbean had begun to settle. In the early morning of Wednesday, 7 June, police waited in their cars outside a house in Cannon Hill Road, just round the corner of Thomas Bates's beloved county ground. It had taken them just 3 days to identify one of the house's many occupants as a live suspect, 20-year-old Oswald Augustus Gray.
So what had led Baumber and his team to the bedsit in Cannon Hill Road, and why was Oswald slash Roy even there?
Well, as to why he was there, it seems it was probably a combination of things, both to do with Felix's father. After the business with him informing on his son, it's difficult to see that they'd want to stay under the same roof together. And now, of course, Oswald was finding his own company in the city, and he'd have known that his father would have disapproved. So, much better for him to be out of sight.
And why did Baumber suspect him?
As we've heard, Baumber knew his territory, and he'd done some homework too. It sounds odd to modern ears, but he'd contacted forces in Merseyside and Manchester who had, quote, experience of working with coloured people. And they'd told him the sort of places to have their eyes and ears. Bookies, labour exchanges, certain workplaces. On top of that, he had his own local network of informers,
including Cecilia Gibbs.
Yes, Cecilia Gibbs. One of the things I've found while doing my research has been, surprise, surprise, that there's plenty of online comment that is pure guesswork, lots of it pretty lurid. Some of this confidently labels her as a prostitute or procuress, but there's nothing to confirm that. But we do know that there wasn't much that passed her by on Lee Bank, and, yeah, it wouldn't have been a surprise if the odd pound note ever changed hands between her and Bounder. But she was only one piece of the jigsaw, and we'll come back to her when we look at the trial.
But the testimony of one probably paid informer and some local gossip doesn't sound like enough to make an arrest, does it?
Well, that's fair comment, except that things were about to take a turn for the worse for Oswald.
In what way?
Well, when they surprised him in his lodgings, they found something pretty incriminating.
A gun?
No, not a gun. Ammunition. But there was a gun located elsewhere. And its whereabouts in the week leading to the death of Thomas Bates was about to exercise everyone's mind.
Gerald Bounder and his two constables surprised Oswald. Unlike most of the residents in the house made up of bedsits, he is not up. He has no work to go to. It does not take them long to find the ammunition, stowed in the drawer of the rickety cabinet. But there is no gun. The policemen fill the dingy room, and they feel Oswell's fuzzy head. Where's the gun, son? And he tells a lie. The first of many lies that will take him to the gallows. You can't hang a man for telling lies. Or can you? Where was the gun? Why did Oswell Gray have it? Where did he get it from? And crucially, what did he do with it? In episode 2 of Who Killed Oswell Gray, we'll reveal the story of the gun and begin to see how the hasty law gave a young Jamaican no chance.
You've been listening to episode 1 of Who Killed Oswald Gray, Lee Bank Road and the Murder of Thomas Bates. You've heard the voices of Sue Brown, Jazzy P, and the writer John Berry. Original music is written and performed by Anthony Williams and Sue Brown. Other music is supplied by Bloodline Music. The producer is Paul Toll and I am Chicken George, executive editor. This has been a GCRB presentation.
Who Killed Oswald Gray is a Genesis Radio production, all rights reserved. For permission to use any part of this broadcast, contact the author John Berry at www.johnberrywriter.co.uk.